Everything was happening so fast. They were like, oh, one of your child made a disclosure that the dad beat him. No, they didn't even use the word beat. I don't know what they use. Physical abuse. I said abuse. All those sort of words wasn't something that we know you are conversant with. They took statements at the police station. After that, they took us to another police station, the headquarters. They say, oh, you're under arrest. I'm like, under arrest? I've never been arrested in my life.
Hi, I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast. Each week, I unpick a single African story that matters, a story that speaks to how we live and the moment we're living in. Just a reminder, if you aren't fully caught up on The Comb, we have a rich archive with more than 80 episodes for you to dip into, on everything from why women join gangs to the experience of being caught up in a crypto scam.
This is The Comb.
Ye ni The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Ni The Comb.
The Comb.
The question of how children should or should not be disciplined is a contentious one, and where you live can play a big part in determining your approach. But what if you live in a different country to where you yourself were raised, where attitudes to discipline differ radically from your own? In this episode, I'm exploring how that tension came to the surface for one Nigerian family living in the UK and how it changed them.
Morning, can I say tickets, please?
A few months ago, I took a train out of London to visit a family that lives on a neat red brick estate in the northwest part of England.
What's your name? Didn't catch your name.
I was let in by Julia, the oldest daughter. She's a 22-year-old medical student, and she helped me set up while we waited for her mother, who I first had been in touch with a few weeks earlier.
I am Dr. Idorin Chalzi Talma, medical doctor, and I work for the NHS.
And do you enjoy your work?
Yeah, I love my job.
This is Judy's mother, Idorin.
Emergency care services.
The story I'm going to tell you begins with her and a big decision the family made some years back. At the time, Idorin was living with her husband and three young kids and training to be a family physician at a local hospital in Nigeria.
There I met one of the consultants that I worked with who told me about this program in England. So, oh, you can go and do this course. It's occupational health course. So I started filling the application. It was an online course. You do some parts back home, then you come here and do exam. That's what I did. That's when I started coming here.
Once in England, Idorin began seeing different opportunities, not just for her, but for her kids too.
And I'm thinking, okay, this might be better for them. How do I come here? Okay, you can change this course and do it full time. Then you can come with your family. Okay.
There was a long list of qualifications that Idorin needed to meet in order to be able to move to the UK. And then once here, she needed to make enough money to bring the rest of her family. But eventually her husband and kids, who were 11, 8 and 5 at the time, were able to join her. And although she was happy to finally have her husband and children with her, Idorin was finding that life with a young family in the UK was very different to what she'd been used to in Nigeria.
Totally different. So you're now finding yourself, just you, the children and your husband. There's no other support.
She missed small things.
No mother bringing you a plantain in the car, out of the car to say, oh, I just got this plantain from the farm. I think you guys will like it.
But above all, she missed having that bigger family support system, like her sisters, who back in Nigeria would frequently come around and help with the children.
Sometimes they used to come to the house and take them away for the weekend. Then we had nothing here. It was just me. I was the one on the visa, so I had to work. So coming here, the adjustment, the whole change was a big shift.
What was the biggest shift for you? What was the biggest difference?
The biggest shift was me being able to be a mother and also be the sole, like, head, still working. I had to work to maintain the visa for us to stay here. So there was a lot of pressure on me, and then pressure for them, me being able to look after them the way I wanted, because I will never be at home, I'm always working. And then their dad was there. So there was a lot of pressure. So sometimes you go and do a night shift, come back, and then as you're coming back, you start cleaning, you have to go shopping, then you have to sleep because you're going for the next night.
Idarin admits that sometimes the stress of holding everything together would get to her and she would shout.
So I think the whole pressure also puts the pressure on the children. Sometimes they will ask me, well, is it that little thing I did that you're shouting like that?
And Idarin says she would also do that thing that many migrant parents do, which is compare their difficult upbringing with their kids' more comfortable one. Take, for example, when her children didn't sort out the laundry. She'd say,
we have washing machine, you have everything. You can't even put the clothes in the washing machine. You can't even, you know, what if you were in the village? Would you not be washing the clothes with your hand? That is how we were washing.
And one of the reasons she'd shout was because of the whispers from other Nigerians about what you could or could not do in the UK, about how you have to discipline your kids in private.
People will whisper to you, oh, you cannot beat your child here, and those, but you can beat them, but don't let them, you know, don't let people know, or don't let the school know that you're, so you can raise them, you can, I'm like, okay, how do you, you cannot beat your child, how else are you going to train them? Because you don't know any other way to,
Having come from a place where discipline was the sole preserve of parents and carers, the notion of the state having a say in how you discipline your child was something hard for her to grasp.
You cannot beat her. Sometimes they are, we have to go back home where we are coming from. Seriously, are you? How can you be a parent and your hands are tied?
Idarin says shouting became her way of getting her children in line.
Intensifying the shout, instilling the fear. He says, so I have to put that fear in my child. Wherever the child is, my fear will go with the child, my authority, my presence.
I asked Julia, the oldest daughter, who's been quietly listening in, what she remembers of this time.
I remember us trying to get into a new environment, learning the new culture. And I remember I was also bullied a lot because I had the thick Nigerian accent and people were always making fun of me and things like that. And I can't remember a lot of my family, like inside what was happening within, like my mom, my dad and my brothers.
You do remember?
Yeah.
What Julia does remember was how different things were, especially at school, compared to her boarding school back in Nigeria.
It was very different for me. And in Nigeria, when a teacher's speaking, you're not speaking. Like, no one is speaking. If the teacher's talking, no one else should be talking. And I remember I had an emotional eruption, so I'm going to call it, that one time that this teacher was speaking, everyone was making noise. I'm like, why are you guys shouting? Why are you guys talking? Literally screamed at the rest of the class, like, why are you guys talking? This teacher's talking. Why can't you shut up? And the teacher was mad at me. And I was just like, they're talking whilst you're talking. I'm trying to get them to conform. And she was upset with me, like, why are you screaming in the class that time? And that was very different, like, learning the different dynamics and stuff like that. And, yeah, it was different.
So this was where the family was at the time, a few years into the move, all of them weathering the stresses of adjusting to this new life in England.
I'll describe it as chaotic, extremely chaotic, no direction.
But then one night, something happened that would completely alter things for the family and force Idarin to rethink much of what she had previously learned about parenting. I should tell you that there were 5 people in the house that night, but we're only going to be hearing from 2 of them. And neither of the 2 were in the room where the crucial events unfolded. We're hearing from Julia first. It was bedtime and she was in her bedroom. Her father was also upstairs in a different room with her 2 younger brothers.
So I remember my dad was trying to get them in bed. And my dad was trying to get them to go to sleep and things like that. And it's always when it's time to go to sleep, everyone is like, no, my phone, this, like they don't want to go to bed. It's just always an argument before bed.
During this argument, Julia's father had physically struck one of her brothers. The next day, her brother went to school.
And normally as the teachers here will ask, oh, why are you like, why is your face like this? Oh, my dad beat me last night.
So when you say, can I just clarify, when you say, what's your face like that? Was it that he had a mark on his face or was he was looking upset?
Upset. No mark on his face. He was just looking upset. We call it carrying a long face, like when you're upset and the teacher, oh, why is your face like this? Oh, that beat me last night. Something like that.
My dad beat me. It's worth noting here that in Nigeria, the word beat is regularly used to cover a wide range of acts. It can be used in place of terms like smacked, slapped, struck, flogged. So it's not always easy to know exactly what form or degree of punishment is being described. And ideally, this is the point in the story when you'd hear from both Idarin's husband and her son, who was a preteen at the time. But although they were both happy for Idarin to share the story, neither of them wanted to revisit the events of that night. In fact, what happened that night is something that the family has never really spoken about since.
If you ask me today what really happened that day, I can't tell you. I wasn't upstairs.
I asked Julia about what happened to her brother.
Have you spoken about it with your brother?
No, I've not spoken about it since then.
At all?
At all.
No one's ever established whether it was a smack, a slap, or anything?
Okay. Like, we've never... Yeah.
And that decision to not revisit what happened that night is likely because of what came after. When her son, still upset about the night before, had gone to school and told the teacher what happened, it set in motion a chain of events.
It was, like thunderstorm. It was a storm just started everywhere. But just that one sentence, the school called police, they called social services, my daughter was in high school. They went to the high school, they brought her out of the class.
I can't remember which class I was in. I think it might have been music or something like this. And they told me to come out, and I went out and I spoke to I think it was a social service person.
And the dad went to pick them from school and said, oh, sorry, there are no children to pick. They are with the police. So he was calling me at work. I'm like, then I saw the missed call. What's happening? He said, he went to pick the children. There are no children to pick. Where are they? Doesn't know. Who picked them? Said the police are coming to the house.
Julia and her brother were now in the care of social services.
Well, we were in this building. We went there. We stayed like for a long time after school, a couple of hours, and then trying to figure out where they were going to place us and things like that. I was just so confused about what was happening.
Idarin raced home. The police were there, waiting.
I think I was shocked, and I saw the policeman and the policewoman in the house, like, what's happening? Say, oh, calm down. We just need you packing the children's bag. I said, packing the children's bag? What's going on? And these children, they're barely 2 years. They were new. They're trying to still understand the culture, the language, the people, you know, like, said, oh, the children are with us. One of the children made a disclosure. So they've taken the children. Can you pack the bag? I was so confused. I said, okay. Everything was happening so fast. It was a police station. They were like, oh, one of your child made a disclosure that the dad beat him. No, they didn't even use the word beat. I don't know what they use. Physical abuse. All those sort of words wasn't something that we know you are conversant with. They took statements at the police station. They say, oh, you're under arrest. I'm like, never been arrested in my life.
In the UK, there are strict laws to ensure the safety of children. And so in this case, until the authorities could fully investigate, they had to remove the children. These safeguarding laws vary from place to place. In Scotland and Wales, for example, any form of physical punishment is illegal and can lead to prosecution. In England and Northern Ireland, it's unlawful for a parent or carer to smack their child, except when it amounts to reasonable punishment, which depends on the circumstances of each case, like the age of the child and the nature of the smack. And across the world, and increasingly on the continent, there is a move to ban physical punishment altogether. For Idarin, the notion that hitting a child could be interpreted as a form of physical abuse, let alone something you could be arrested for, was so far from her own experience. Growing up in what she calls Nigeria's South-South, which is Akwa Ibom State, her family had a very particular approach to disciplining kids. and the core of Idarin's identity as a parent had been forged around these experiences.
My father was the second of seven brothers, and the senior brother lived across the road, opposite us. My father lived opposite him, and then the brothers all live around. It was a big compound that if you come out of your house, you can't go anywhere without your uncle seeing you and asking, where are you up to? Somebody's always over there in the window or somewhere, or where are you up to? You can have five or six, where are you going to before you even step close to the road? We're all very close-knitted at the time.
There were some advantages to communal living, like being able to drop by in any of the many aunties and uncles' houses and have lunch or dinner. But when it came to discipline, the approach was also communal.
My senior uncle's house was the venue. There was always this bigger family meeting where at the end of the school year, there's this bigger family meeting, all the uncles, everybody with your exam report, and they're reading it. And it was really intense that time. And there was this, cousin did this, and then there was always a table where there would be punishment for different things. So if you were one of those to be punished, you would be brought in to the panel and you stand before them.
There was a long list of punishable offences that could land you there, from doing badly at school to sneaking out without permission. And once an offence was established, then a specific uncle would step in.
One of my uncles, who was a head teacher, so they call him a disciplinarian. Oh, he was the head teacher. He was the one that always have to flog. So he's the one that will know how many strokes of that cane you need for that offence. He's the one that can, because he was the head teacher.
So he brought the experience.
Yeah, he has the experience. Wow. Yeah, so they will leave it for him to decide.
Were you ever flogged? Did you ever face the panel in any way?
I wasn't flogged. I had punishment.
Like?
Punishment like farm, big portions of farm to do, weeding.
As well as weeding big patches of farmland, punishments would include housework and making sure you execute it to a particular level and repeating it until she attained that level. Like making her father's bed with precision or risk having to make it again and again. What was clear to Idarin was that there was a hierarchy that was to be observed and respected at all times.
You couldn't really have your voice as a child. It was always other people's voices, other people, what they want you to do, other people, how they want you to be, expectations of you.
And so when she left home and got married and had children, that model of being the voice of authority was the one she took with her.
Not democratic, it was just authoritative. That is what I'm saying you should do. You have to do it. It's because I'm your mother.
As Idarin is saying this, you can see Julia laughing in the background with the look of someone who remembers this line really well.
It was all I knew at the time, because I had my children back in Nigeria, and all I knew was the way I was raised. It doesn't mean that we are not good parents, but this is how we were brought up.
There'd never been any reason for Idarin to question how they disciplined their children until now, when she found herself separated from them, arrested, and struggling to understand what was happening.
You're under arrest. They put me in this cubicle room for almost 6 to 8 hours. I'm like, what is going on? You have no idea. And then they come and take you out, sit you here. Police was like, you committed proper crime. Like I robbed the bank or I killed somebody, murdered. I'm like, you're a proper murderer.
Once they'd paid bail and were released, the days that followed were filled with frantic attempts to get their children back.
We had to quickly look for a lawyer, and every day new information. Oh, we are moving the children from emergency protection. I'm constantly searching for information. What does emergency protection mean?
Julia and her brothers were in emergency protection, meaning they were taken in by foster parents. Julia remembers trying to make life as normal as she could for her and her brothers.
I was very anxious, and I was trying to keep the same routine as we knew at home.
Like what?
Like before bed, we always prayed together. And there was a time that my brothers, because they've come down here, there's no strict routine or anything. So they were taking advantage of like no strict routine. So I'm here trying to keep the peace or trying to keep everything like I know how it being. And I was trying to force them, we have to pray. Like, we always do this before we sleep, like, we have to pray. And they're like, no, we don't want to pray. And I was so angry. Like, I was like, we have to try and keep things the way that we know.
After days of calls, their parents finally found a private lawyer.
He started breaking down these laws for me, explaining everything. That is the only place I could get a bit of understanding, breaking everything down, what is going to happen if we don't do this, this is what is going to happen.
And what was that like for you, that experience of someone explaining to you so you've understood the full picture of what was happening?
Heaven. Like, at least you have tools to work with. From that moment I met with that solicitor, it didn't take the next 14 days. Everything started working out well. Everything started going according to legal things. And then I think within 3 weeks of the whole trauma, then we had the children back home.
There's a line that Julia uses to describe how delicate things were when they were finally able to return home. Her parents, perhaps still reeling from the shock of having had their children removed, were terrified of it happening again.
Our parents, they treated us like eggs. Like, they didn't want to break it, or they didn't want, like, they were just very, anything that you want, you get. And for a long time, I saw how they, I don't know, like, they kind of, I would say they kind of lost their power as parents.
Here's how Idarin sees it.
I don't think things have ever been, like, same. Relationships, I think everybody trying to be very over-cautious, agey. Maybe there's something you want to say or do you don't.
But with that cautiousness has come something else, a desire to do things differently.
I studied so many laws, so many. I was ready to go even to European Union to fight for my children. So I was reading, even not just UK law, I was reading European law, you know, concerning children, what you can do, what you can. I was ready, but, well, with the lawyer's help and everything, with God's help and everything, the children came back. Then you start opening your eyes to looking at then, okay, what do I need to do now? How do I need to behave now?
The answer to that question, how do I need to behave now, has set Idarin on a journey that has seen her let go of the many ways she previously approached discipline and parenting.
What did this change for you in terms of how you parent?
It was being more present for me, like making sure like that I know what is going on, and also taking their emotions into consideration, and at the same time, not letting them forget our roots, which is we are Africans. You are a black child, and that's nothing that anybody can hide. You are a black child. Finding that balance.
And so for the past few years, Idarin has been trying to find that balance and essentially unlearn and relearn what it means to be a parent.
For me, a lot of learning, a lot of reading. At every stage of their growth, I will have the videos of how do you parent a 14-year-old? How do you parent a 10-year-old? How will you parent a 16-year-old? I listen to a lot of podcasts. Then you change your style as they are growing, learning more skills to help you be a better parent.
Idarin has begun working with other African parents, holding talks and seminars.
This is a gospel I want to preach. Mm-hmm. When we come here, we are coming to Britain with a set mindset. A set mindset you grew up with, a set mindset, inherent behavior and character, the way you were brought up. This is who I am. I will not change. They can remove your child if you're careless, if you're not, like, willing to learn and unlearn.
It's a conversation that is becoming increasingly urgent. While researching this episode, I spoke to Dr. Cynthia Okpiri, a social worker, who, after seeing case upon case of children being removed, decided to research what she saw as the overrepresentation of Black African children in the child protection system, and the complicated cycle of fear, distrust, and misunderstanding that she says sometimes comes into play. Even governments are getting involved. The Nigerian High Commission has also taken steps to raise awareness around the issue.
Nigerian-born parents need to be educated about the possible penalties of disciplining their children too harshly. That's according to officials from the country's High Commission in London. It told us today it's dealing with an avalanche of cases of children being taken into care because their parents are being prosecuted for excessively beating them.
The events of that night have had enormous consequences for everyone. For Julia, the oldest daughter, coming to terms with what happened during those 3 weeks was not easy. But now hearing her mother's story, some of it for the first time, has given her a deeper appreciation of the journey her mother has been on.
What do you think of what your mum's doing now?
I think it's really good. I think that many parents, they, like we said in the seminar last week, you see this life for your children, you bring them all the way over here, but then you're working all the time. And then you're working all the time, you're under so much stress, and a child breaks a glass or breaks something, and then you think this is all. Like, you're not thinking in the moment that, oh, you're releasing your stress onto this child by hitting or by screaming or by doing this, but that's what you're doing. And the child is just thinking, oh, I'm such a burden. I think it's good for parents to know, like, there are other ways to discipline a child than what you know. And sometimes when I think about my relationship with my parents and before everything that happened, it's like they can only, and not only my parents, everyone, they can only do from what they know. They can only act from what they know. And like my mom said, all she knew was the panel and everything. Like, so she can only act from what she knows.
And what about your relationship with your kids? How is it?
It's good. It's, every day is learning for me, relearning and getting better. So I think, yeah, we still have hitches, which every parent have. But overall, we are in a good place. We're in a good place with my daughter, I'm in a good place with my sons. And I'm always more self-reflecting, okay, I could do this better, okay, I'll have this, I'll do this the other way around. I still have, no one is perfect, but it's much, much better. And I feel like they are more comfortable talking to me and discussing than maybe if we were back then. I don't think they would talk to me about anything.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, then please take a moment to rate us or leave us a review wherever you may be listening from. It's a useful way to help other people discover the comb. Next week, what it's like to be falsely accused and found guilty. This episode was produced by me, Kim Chakaneta, and Mary Goodhart. Piers Lynch is our editor. Our sound design is by Joel Cox. Stuart Hollingdrake was our studio manager. And a special thanks to Dr. Cynthia Okpiri and Afruka Safeguarding Children for their help with this episode.